Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Paul Dutton. He's a professor of history at Northern Arizona University and a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. His latest book is Differential Diagnoses, a Comparative History of Healthcare Problems and Solutions in the United States and France, published by Cornell University Press. Welcome, Paul Dutton, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
You compare the French and United States healthcare systems, and you begin by noting that they're both grounded in their revolutions, the French Revolution and the American Revolution of the 18th century. Tell us about this, which is really a matter of philosophical principles.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you started there, because it does set the stage here, and at first sort of blush, it doesn't appear to have anything to do with healthcare, but I argue that it does as a historian. I mean, let's go back to the revolutions here for a minute, just briefly. I mean, if you look at the French Revolution to start with, happening in the late 18th century, the French, under the First Republic, as it's known in France, had a very strong state, right? And they needed to. They executed their king and queen in order to bring about liberty and equality in France at that time, or to the extent that they could. And so I think that sets the stage for a very active state in France. In the United States, of course, the American colonists were able to expel the Redcoats, kick the king out of North America, or at least part of North America. But after the Redcoats had departed, of course, with the help of the French, as it turns out, it became a question of a rather weak state. Now, the question of liberty and equality were still foremost in the eyes of the founders, but they completely ignored slavery in the United States at the time and chose a weaker state system, a federal system ultimately, or even weaker, the Articles of Confederation to begin with. And I think that sets the stage a bit for the healthcare debates that began to happen more than 100 years later, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, we start to have these debates, again, both in France and the United States, as to whether or not health insurance should be a public good, a common good, and in some way compulsory for people to buy health insurance. Again, the question in both countries, at the workplace. And so I think that philosophical, as you said, the philosophical foundations sets the stage for the different outcomes that we have in both countries, in each country, I should say, by the end of the 20th century. In fact, that's one of the things that the book runs from 1917 to 2007. And if you look at the healthcare systems, if that's a correct term, in 1917, France and the United States had virtually identical healthcare systems in 1917. And, of course, by 2007, they're very different.
I mean, that's a really interesting point that you bring up in the book, that 100 years ago, the two systems were so similar. What were they, in fact, like? What was healthcare like for normal people in the United States and in France?
In both cases, men, stably employed men, could buy, white men, in the case of the United States, certainly, could join health insurance clubs. Fraternal orders would be a good example, where they could buy protection against the risk of illness and accident. Oftentimes it was through their workplace or through their some sort of socioeconomic, socio-professional status. And these were not-for-profit kind of clubs of sorts. And in France, a similar situation, actually. Their organizations were known as mutual societies. Again, stably employed men could buy into these health insurance clubs, and for the most part, they were protecting themselves against lost wages, and the medical bills at that time were not a major factor. It was called illness insurance, in fact, for that reason. It wasn't to pay doctors' bills so much, because they paled in comparison to what the lost wages might be for you know, if you somehow became ill and couldn't go to work for a couple of weeks, even if you were seriously ill, medical intervention just wasn't that expensive back then. So, and if that's on the coverage side, in terms of providers, again, very similar. Each country had the sort of fledgling medical associations, medical professions. Let's take the doctors. Very vehement in their defense of and insistence on fee-for-service private practice medicine. In fact, I'd start the book in the early pages. I have this sort of fictitious, but I think very accurate, typical conversation that might take place between an American physician and a French physician who are both posted to the Western Front during the First World War, because, of course, that was occurring in 1917. And the American and the French physician, they're comparing their articles from their respective medical journals, and they're virtually the same in terms of their arguments. The Germans are bad, right? They're responsible for everything evil, not just the war, but the Germans, in fact, had created a system of compulsory public health insurance in Germany. And so the Americans and French were scared that that would spread, perhaps, to their countries. And the British, by the way, were also involved in that war. I have a little British physician involved in this conversation. And in this case, a he, because physicians were predominantly men at that time, were the British physician is actually supportive of some sort of state-sponsored health insurance, because the British moved in that direction beginning in 1912. But the French and Americans, that Franco-American camaraderie was very strong at that point among physicians, and they have very similar ideals. And to this day, I think they have similar ideals.
What was the actual practice of medicine like? I mean, you talk in the book about the battle between scientific medicine and other forms of healing. What I mean, if you had an illness or an injury, what were your options, and what was the practice of healing like?
Well, the most commonly taken option at this period was to let the malady run its course. And even a wonderful, very aggressive physician today will tell you in lots of cases the patient will be okay after much suffering of some sort. That was a common option, but at this time, what we think of as science-based medicine, what is referred to in the field as allopathic medicine, was actually fighting against other kinds of healers. Any of your listeners who have looked through old National Geographics or old magazines from the teens, they've seen sort of remedies of various sorts promising all sorts of different things. I guess we still have that today, don't we? But they were much more common and more commonly used by a wider swath of the population. So the idea that there was going to be a science-based medicine with this whole system of medical training and medical education and licensing really didn't, was just, as I said, fledgling at this time. Because ultimately, and the status of doctors, I should also mention, is tied to this, because we think of physicians today highly paid in this country for the most part, and in terms of social class, very, very high. I don't know, back in the 19-teens, doctors did not hold this social class or social standing, if I can put it that way, as high as, say, university professors, to make a comparison close to home. They were seen as more small businessmen, sort of petty bourgeois, trying to make a go of it with claiming techniques of healing that others in the public square were also claiming. And they were not the guardians, as they are today, of stupendously powerful and effective pharmaceuticals and, you know, diagnostic imaging and things like this. So I think that one needs to bear that in mind as we talk today, the transformation of medical practice, not just of what doctors, you know, sort of how they operated and who was covered and how it was paid for, but also of the practice of medicine itself.
We're talking to Paul Dutton, author of Differential Diagnoses. What was the contribution of progressive reformers in the early 20th century? I mean, this was a period of rapid and dramatic industrialization, which had consequences for worker health and safety.
Yeah, this is the first battle that I trace, and they happen about the same time in the United States and France. In the case of the U.S., of course, some of your listeners who remember their history will remember this capital P progressive movement. Teddy Roosevelt, early president of the 20th century, was a member of this group. But they were diverse. And there was a group of them that launched an effort in 1916 to, on a state-by-state basis, they wanted to bring about compulsory health insurance for the working class. So they're a relatively small group, but a group that was disconnected, had migrated to the cities, disconnected from their maybe rural origins. And they went on it, as I said, on a state-by-state basis, just as the workers' comp law, in fact, in this country are the same way. There are state laws. And that brought to the fore, and to some extent, it really motivated, and there is a feedback effect that takes place, I argue, in the book here, is that I characterized the American Medical Association earlier as fledgling during the 1910s. I think that's a true characterization. But once they're confronted with this movement by these progressives in 1916 to 1918, 1919, boy, they really get organized. They reorganized. They could become a real powerful headquarters, centralized headquarters in Chicago, and their political lobbying wing is created and bolstered, and they fight this, and they actually turn it around. What looked like it was going to be fairly easy to approve on a state-by-state basis, at least in some states in the Northeast and in Michigan, elsewhere, California, they block it entirely. And so in France, the battle takes place, the same kind of movement, progressive movement, in the 1920s. And that's kind of an interesting little story, and maybe I'll take an extra minute here in answering this. Because once France had won the First World War in 1918, defeating Germany, they actually regained a portion of their territory that they had lost to the Germans in the 19th century. And as I said before, the Germans had created compulsory health insurance on their territory. So France actually regained this territory. They ended up with this Alsace-Lorraine, it's known as, inside their country now, and the people there say, we want to keep this national, public health insurance that workers and employers are contributing to. So the French are forced into the debate in the 20s as to how to deal with this. Are we going to do away with it in Alsace-Lorraine, or are we going to spread it to the entire territory? They end up spreading it to the entire territory of France, but they modify it substantially. And that is a debate that takes place. As I say, I describe this in the book, whereas in the American case, the medical profession blocks it. In the French case, the medical profession, a lot of fighting goes on, infighting. Ultimately, the medical profession comes forward and says, look, we'll cooperate with this compulsory health insurance for the industrial workers as long as you guarantee to us in statute that we will have control of medical decision-making, total control of clinical decision-making, and that patients will have complete choice of doctors, right? So you have this kind of quid pro quo in France that really is still valid all the way to this day. I mean, when you have conflicts, as you do in France, between the large public insurer, Sécurité Sociale, and the medical profession, you hear doctors, leaders of the medical profession say, we want to protect the charte médicale, which is something they actually, that was the name of this thing, the medical charter, to translate, that they signed in 1930 when they implemented their first sort of round of health insurance, national health insurance.
Why were American physicians so vehemently against this kind of insurance?
They saw it as the thin edge of a wedge to the end of private practice fee-for-service medicine. And the French did not, ultimately. They saw it as a way of protecting private practice fee-for-service medicine, which they did. I mean, that's exactly, in fact, the Charte Médicale says very clearly, the medical charter in France says very clearly that, the only kind of truly legal and ethical practice of medicine is fee-for-service. Whereas I think it has to do with different judgments at the time, different views. And again, you asked that great question at the beginning, in terms of the role of the state, the government, that is. In France, I think, as I do, I argue in the book, that the government is viewed as not just something to be feared for its intervention, but as an entity that can actually, as a guarantor, as an entity that can actually help maintain liberty, and in this case, the liberty of medical practice. So the French physicians look to the state to guarantee their continued use of fee-for-service private practice medicine. That wasn't the feeling and the thinking of at least the dominant thinking in the leadership of the American Medical Association at the time. I don't want to broad brush this too much. There were plenty of physicians in 1916 who thought national health insurance was a good idea, but they didn't win the day.
Well, and when we go back to the philosophical underpinnings, we have equality and liberty,
yes,
which are ideals in both countries and many, many other countries as well. But is there inherently a tension between those two things where the health debate is concerned?
Well, I mean, that is the tensions that I argue in the book that underlie all these subsequent debates that go on, these battles, healthcare reform battles. And look, it comes down to how the various sides use the language, and the rhetoric is very interesting, right? I mean, those who were arguing against compulsory health insurance at the time, and it's actually very topical because nowadays the Democrats in the primaries are arguing about mandates, and Obama doesn't require a mandate, Clinton says, and, this is the debate that's going on. And so, but back throughout the debates and back to the teens or even in the 40s, and maybe in the 30s and 40s, we can talk about that, is that, those who were arguing in favor of some sort of compulsory health insurance for workers or some portion of them said, look, yes, we're going to actually, you're going to have to, lose a little bit of your cash wages, so we will, you have to give up a little liberty there, but in fact, you're going to be more free in the end because you're freed from the the fear of medical indigence. You're not going to be on the street for lack of care or some sort of wage stipend that could result from having insurance. Of course, then on the other side, those who wanted to did not want compulsory health insurance argued, no, workers, it should be voluntary, or better yet, workers should get together and use their unions and their fraternal orders, et cetera, to buy their own insurance. And which was, in fact, the argument of the founder of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, actually was opposed to this first effort of health insurance that I describe in the book. So there is a tradition of, this is a tradition of rugged individualism early on in the country. And it does, as you say, I think there's all that notion of, are they going to seek interdependent citizenship, or is it individualism? The various names are used, and then later, of course, during the Cold War, it's private enterprise versus communism, you see. So those underpinnings, though, liberty and equality, yes, I think there is some inherent tension, not necessarily, but oftentimes there is between them, but they're called different things throughout the 20th century.
One of the big differences between the United States and France is that here health insurance is pretty much tied to employment, and there it really isn't. Why the difference? Let's look at that historically up to the present.
Well, this the first part of your question is absolutely correct, I agree with. However, the French still are tied to their workplace, although decreasingly so. So I guess I don't totally agree with the premise of the question, but let me talk about it here for a minute. In both countries, you had where, or in the early days, you could have men, stably employed men, as I said, could buy into these health insurance clubs, called different things in each country. But that actually sets in play the notion that workers, that's where health coverage belongs, so to speak, right? So even though the French move, and let's move forward now into the 1940s, and especially right after the Second World War in France in 1945, when the French create their current system of Sécurité sociale, they continue to pay for it their health insurance coverage out of their payroll levies and wage taxes. And the United States, many of your listeners are probably, you know, loosely aware that that's when employment-based, that is during the Second World War, is when employment-based health insurance really took off in this country, because war manufacturers were not allowed to raise wages during the Second World War, or very small wage increases. And in order to retain the best workers, so they gave health insurance benefits, which at that time were very relatively cheap, right? So that is how this grows out in the mid-20th century, and both countries relying on health insurance really paid for at the workplace. That, of course, has become a real problem ultimately, because in this country now, we thought we were headed towards universal coverage, and there were plenty of people in the 50s that said, you know, this is going great. More and more people are being covered every year. In fact, by the mid-50s, 90% of the members of the CIO had health insurance coverage, right? We were really moving along rather nicely, but then it became apparent very quickly by the time you get to the late 50s, early 60s, that the poor, the elderly, were never going to, and members, you know, people from unorganized sectors of the economy, were never going to get coverage. And so, really, Medicare, which covers the elderly, and Medicaid, which covers the working poor, that was sort of written into the story very early on, once the country started down this road of private voluntary health insurance, because certain sectors were always going to get left out. In the French case, of course, you have an increasing expansion of Sécurité Sociale, so that by the mid-80s, late 80s certainly, they had 95% coverage, and they finally achieved universal coverage through their system in 2000.
I guess the question is based partly on an example that you gave in your book of a couple in the United States, both of them gainfully employed, insured under his insurance. The man is suddenly laid off in the when the high-tech bubble burst, and a week after he's laid off, she's diagnosed with an invasive cancer, and it becomes an insurance nightmare, and this would never happen in France.
Right, and this is because they have really since, as I said, the mid-80s and certainly since 2000, even someone who is unemployed is part of a special fund that guarantees health coverage. So, and this is, again, I see where you're going with this question, that the French have moved away from relying solely on payroll to pay for their health insurance. They're still relying on about 50% of the money's come out of payroll taxes, and the other comes from general income taxes, taxes on profits and rents, dividends, et cetera. So there they have a pot of money that's managed by Sécurité Sociale, which I want to be specific about this. Actually, Sécurité Sociale is not it's a sort of a public agency that is managed by, administered by leaders of the unions in France and employers. And, of course, the government representatives also sit at the table. But it's a lot less government of an agency than, for example, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is in this country. It's Sécurité Sociale is actually a public agency run by unions and employers. It's not really a government agency, but that's how they have a special system to cover the unemployed, and so you wouldn't have that happen in the case of France.
We're talking to Paul Dutton, author of Differential Diagnoses, A Comparative History of Healthcare Problems and Solutions in the United States and France. One thing you say, I think close to the beginning of the book, is that whereas the United States is largely, for people who have health insurance at all, it's private health insurance with public aid that comes in around the edges. And in France, it's pretty much the reverse case. There is private health insurance, but it's not the lion's share of the insurance.
That's right. And so, and that's another way to think about this, you know, that their system is kind of it's a mirror image of ours. They have a large public insurer that's spending about three quarters, 75% of their healthcare outlays are coming out of Securité Sociale, a public insurer. And then they have this very large and very vibrant private health insurance sector, because the Securité Sociale is really just a sort of a safety net insurer, if for ambulatory care anyway. So if I go to the doctor today, and I'm in Paris, and certainly lived in France a lot, and especially had my kids in, young children into the doctor there a lot, there I would be responsible for paying, the Securité Sociale covers 70% of the doctor's visit. But if I'm one of the 86% of French that have a supplemental private insurance, then that insurance would cover most of the remaining 30%. So that's kind of how it works. There's a big public insurer, and the private insurers cover a balance. Of course, in this country, it's a large mix. We have, though, a very large public sector in this country, maybe larger than your listeners realize, and so I'll mention the statistic. 46% of all the healthcare expenditures in this country, when you add up Medicare, Medicaid, the Veterans Health Administration, Indian Health Service, et cetera, 46% is government. And it's increasingly government as we age, right, as more people rely on Medicare as they age and leave employment, and of course, as more people lose their private health insurance, which is dropping like a lead weight at the moment, right? We've lost about 9 percentage points from 69% to 60% of employers offering private health insurance. It's down 9% in the last 7 years. They rely on Medicaid. So the public bill is going up. The private sector of the American system is falling. So we're becoming more French-like, if you will, in our proportions, but we're not talking about it. I mean, that's why I look forward to this, what appears to be a brewing round of healthcare debate in this next election cycle.
Well, it's interesting also because, as you say, when people get gravely ill in France, 100% of their expenses are covered. And that isn't true here. And in fact, there are many stories of people who have health insurance who still go bankrupt when there's a terrible medical crisis in their family.
That's it. I'm so glad you brought it up because I should have finished that. On the ambulatory side, yeah, it's 70% coverage from the public insurer. But if you're flat on your back in intensive care or anywhere in the hospital, the coverage becomes 100%. So the sicker you are in France, the better the coverage, which is perhaps the inverse is true here to some extent. This is true now. A study now has shown that we went back and they looked at, I think it was in 2004, they looked at all of the personal bankruptcies nationwide in the United States, and they found that 51% of them were directly tied to medical bills. So I argue in the book that, you know, we need to deal with this. Otherwise, we're gonna bankrupt not only ourselves individually and personally, but in many cases, but also the public budgets, right? I mean, Medicare costs are going to increase by 99% by 2013. That's not very far away.
Yeah.
We need to look at this seriously and look at some forthright reforms to get us back on track.
Well, you note in the book that many Americans have kind of a knee-jerk response to socialized medicine. You mentioned that you are a professor studying the medical system in France, and almost on cue, people say, oh, socialized medicine. Is there necessarily we've been talking about this, the dichotomy between public and private medicine. How do you get past that kind of dismissive response on the part of Americans?
Well, I think, you know, historically it comes out of the late 40s, when Harry Truman was a proponent of a national health insurance system, and it was also the ramping up of the Cold War, and we had the creation of this epithet really becomes prominent, especially out of the American Medical Association, and that spreads throughout anybody who's opposed to it, this notion that, well, if you're for a larger public sector in this area that has previously been completely private, private sector fee-for-service medicine, then you're not quite American. You're kind of, well, as the president of the American Medical Association used to say, you're pinkish. I mean, this was common parlance at the time for somebody, a communist sympathizer, traitorous, etc. And that really stuck, actually. And so the Cold War, and this is fascinating, of course, anybody who studies the history of American social policy can look at international events and look at how they affected domestic issues. And the healthcare is a prime example of that, I think, of that with socialized medicine. But look, to get straight to your question, I think if you start to, one of the goals of my book is not just to trace the history and explain that, but also to argue that we need to be looking out at other systems, because ours, in fact, just the statistics I cited earlier, we are a public-private healthcare system, and so are the rest.
Right.
It just so happens that the French system is more public, but it's certainly not as public and government-run as, say, the Canadian or the British. In fact, I can easily sit here and argue with you that the French system resembles the American more than it does the British, if you look at dollars spent out of the government treasury and what role the private sector and private insurers and whether the doctors are in private practice, et cetera, because in France, of course, vast majority of ambulatory care doctors are in private practice, fee-for-service practice. And they have far more, typically, they have more control over their medical decision-making than American doctors, because American doctors now are so subject to the rules and incentives and punishments of the managed care insurance networks that they belong to. French doctors don't face that. So this is, of course, I really argue that we need to be looking at lots of different systems and understand that there's not just our system and then, well, everybody else, socialized medicine.
I think when you talk about this concept of, you know, pinkish, it seems to me, and again, reading your book made me think about this again, that a hostility toward communism really taints everything that has any kind of collectivism at all built into it as suspect. And, you know, the fact is we live in an just inherently interdependent society. And, you know, the ideal of rugged individualism is just it's just non-existent. It's a thing of the past. Who isn't dependent on everybody else in their community in one way or another? I mean, from the roads we drive on to the buildings we live in, nobody does everything themselves.
Yeah, and quite, that's a, you know, I think a very astute observation, and it's an undercurrent in the book. Ultimately, and I even sort of deconstruct the word, socialized in the book, because what does that mean, really? Well, if I'm in an auto accident, God forbid, this afternoon, I actually have private health insurance. But those auto accidents can cost, if I end up with an ambulance ride, even for a minor accident, in the tens of thousands of dollars, right? But I'm relying on the other members of Blue Cross Blue Shield to help pay my medical bills. I mean, and in fact, the relevant statistic here is that 80% of the healthcare expenditures in this country go to care for 20% of the sickest and most unfortunate, and many of them near the end of life, so with chronic diseases. And so, you know, that by definition almost, with the cost of medical care these days, it has to be socialized. The question is just how to do it, right? I mean, ultimately, are you going to have public agencies, private agencies, a mix? Well, I think there should be a mix. That's what the French have. That's what we have now. It's just ours isn't very, very rational. It's just costing us, we're spending $6,100 per capita in this country, 16% of GDP. That's projected to go, conservative projection is 20% of GDP by 2016. And that's over $4 trillion. It's going to be one out of every $5 that we spend in the economy is going to be on healthcare. Whereas the French healthcare system is rated number one by the World Health Organization. They're paying $3,500 per person, spending about 11% of GDP. I'm not saying they don't have problems. They certainly do. You can't name a country that doesn't, with healthcare inflation especially. But we have got a lot of inefficiencies in the system and a lot of people left out of it entirely that we need to look abroad and look at the various solutions that other countries have come to, whether they're imperfect as they are, and try to learn from them. And other countries are certainly looking at our system. And I point this out in the book, how this works. The French have been borrowing from the American healthcare system for quite some time.
When you talk about all the money that the United States spends on healthcare, how much of it is actually for healthcare versus the bureaucracies such as managed care, the insurance company, the desk jobs, the people in doctor's offices who are trying to make sense of the whole thing? How much of it is actual healthcare versus paper pushing and bureaucracy?
That is one of the biggest, you know, the big piece of fat in the U.S. healthcare system, the biggest identifiable piece of fat anyway, is on administrative overhead of private health insurance. It's very, very high. And so you've got, and I'll be generous now, the administrative overhead of private health insurance company in this country, they start at about 15%. And they spend a lot of money on trying to figure out whom to exclude from coverage. A lot of money, of course, goes to billing and the very complex billing arrangements that are between insurers and providers. Compare that with the public insurer in France, which runs administrative overhead of just below 5%, about a third, or for that matter, our own public insurer, Medicare. Their administrative overhead is 3.2%. So there you have, I think, a place in which tremendous savings could be found very, very quickly. Of course, it would change the nature of insurers if you regulated them to the extent that they weren't allowed, for example. And this is kind of on the table now with some of the Democratic plans of doing away with some of the what is known in the industry as experience rating of employer groups or individuals, certainly, you know, asking for, you know, guaranteed issue insurance and whatnot, and also trying to simplify the billing. I have a friend here who works, runs a billing office for a rather large medical practice. He said that, you know, he has to really know how to deal with up to 200 insurance billing procedures. Well, it costs him a lot of money. He has to hire very highly trained people who have to stay updated on their skills and the various changing processes of insurance companies, who ultimately, in some cases, don't want to pay, right? It becomes this game. And so there is a large piece of that 16% of GDP, I think, that is, as you say, not going for medical care or patient care.
And there's a cruelty also to this a huge amount of money that is spent in trying to exclude people, you know, for whatever reason, pre-existing conditions or this isn't covered or whatever. And it goes to something that you discuss in the book, which is loosely, the distinctions between deserving and less deserving citizens.
Yes.
How has that played out historically, this distinction?
Well, you know, let me hark back a little bit to some of our earlier, just, you know, a few minutes ago when we were talking about how these mutual societies and the fraternal orders in both countries, we had this idea that, well, you know, if somebody gives up in this 19-teens again, or 19th century for that matter, if a man were willing to give up a little portion of his cash wages, that is, contribute to buy into a health insurance club, that somehow he deserved to get care or to get a wage replacement stipend if he were to be unable to work. And that kind of thinking, I argue in the book, still exists in this country today. It's become almost unconscious. But I think that if you look at the ongoing debate over SCHIP, right,
mm-hmm.
Which is the state children's health insurance programs, and people mostly on the Republican side, but on both sides of the aisle, arguing that, no, we can't have health insurance coverage for children that come from families who are middle class. And so you say, well, why not? Well, their argument to that is that, well, because they haven't contributed to ultimately. But if you ask the same member of Congress, do middle class families in this country have trouble buying health insurance? The answer is yes. So my, of course, immediate reaction is, well, that person must believe that just because you're middle class and you haven't contributed at the workplace, you don't deserve health insurance, you see, even if somehow you're paying for it ultimately through income taxes. So this, I think, is a mindset, a consciousness about health security, a term I use in the book, of health coverage, that you know, it's a 19th century thing that we're still holding on to, that somehow you got to pay for it at the workplace, and if you haven't, well, you don't deserve it.
You talk about the French system as being it's a public agency in which labor unions have a role, and I think it's probably useful to compare the difference between labor union power and place in society in France and the United States.
Yes, and this is maybe, sometimes when I talk to groups, they assume that the labor unions in France are very, very powerful. They are in certain sectors, especially in the public sector, which is heavily unionized. But in terms of the overall unionization rate, it's about the same as the United States. It's around, I'm not a labor historian, but it's about 12% now in this country, maybe a little bit lower. It's about 12 or 13% in France as well. Except that the difference you have seen here, and again, we go back to that wonderful question you asked earlier about the role of the state and the government and how it's viewed. Labor unions in France from the get-go, like some of the unions in this country, but labor unions in France much more unanimously, they looked for legislation to guarantee their access to health care. And so that's why you ended up with this succession of health insurance laws, 1930, 1945, again in 61, 68, that eventually brought 100% coverage to the population. Whereas in this country, as I said before, the AFL, the CIO, and then AFL-CIO after they came together in the 50s, they were actually doing very well for themselves at the collective bargaining table, right? I mean, they were getting from employers and management good coverage for their workers. They weren't, in many cases, auto workers, let's take for example, didn't even have to contribute to premiums, right? So you had a dynamic that sets in, and actually this is well documented, and I talk about this in the book, where you had union leaders in the late 40s who were talking to members of Congress and saying, wow, you know, you and you're working with the president, Truman at the time, you're pushing a national health insurance system, but you know, wait a minute, the system you want to pass legislatively is workers are going to have to pay for a portion of the premium. Well, right now, the employer's paying all of it. It's hard for us to organize and mobilize the rank and file in favor of that. So I make this point in the book that unions are if you're taking the viewpoint of, you know, who's to blame for the lack of national health insurance in the United States in 2007, unions bear part of the blame. They were looking out for their membership and not turning to the government for the common good, to use the term that you used a little while ago.
Which is ironic because those very companies are kind of a fickle partner who can then, whenever they want to, withdraw whatever their agreements were, you know, years or decades later.
Yeah, and that's why I say, look, you know, unions in the United States really kind of, they bought a false diamond, kind of, right? They thought they were getting the real thing, great coverage. Well, boom, you know, now we look at GM, Ford, Chrysler, you know, union organized sectors throughout the country are saying, you know, these employers can't afford the health insurance anymore, and they're going to stop offering it. They're going to make us pay more, or they're going to create these benefit associations.
Or they'll lay us off and move the company to Mexico.
Or that. There you go. So this is a dynamic that, again, I know you didn't ask this, but there is kind of a symmetry to this from the union side, also to the doctors, because, you know, I think that there are certainly physicians in this country who, after reading the book, say, boy, I kind of wish that American doctors had made the same deal that French doctors did in 1930, you know, that protected their medical decision-making prerogatives from insurers, whether they be public or private.
Well, is that kind of reform, is it too late for that now? I mean, what kind of political movement do you think is necessary in this country to make positive change?
I do think that the movers and shakers now, the AMA is still very powerful, but it's the specialty groups that are very powerful, that is, the surgeons and et cetera, that have their own organizations. And then, of course, the pharmaceuticals, big pharma, and the health insurance companies, managed care corporations. Those are the movers and shakers, I think. And in terms of compromises, if that's where you want to go, I think if physicians, in 1994, the College of American Surgeons came out in favor of Medicare for All. And the reason was is because Medicare relies a lot on fee-for-service, and that's what they wanted. They were being run over by managed care. So this is, I think, a dynamic that could be developed further if increasing numbers of doctors were to come out in favor of some sort of national health insurance, as long as it guaranteed their clinical decision-making powers, professional judgments, that is. And on the insurance side, that may be, I mean, if you look at the French model, ultimately the private insurers conceded considerable ground in France, but they weren't wiped out entirely. There is that supplemental market that I mentioned earlier, which is a very important part of the French healthcare system, and there's, as I said, a booming private health insurance market.
Well, we are just about out of time. Paul Dutton, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Paul Dutton, professor of history at Northern Arizona University and a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and about his book, Differential Diagnoses, A Comparative History of Healthcare Problems and Solutions in the United States and France. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Thank you.